Remember where we are in the in our program. We started with the Hamiltonian formalism, special relativistic, and then did the Lejeune transform to arrive at a covariant formulation, fully covariant formulation within special relativity, the so-called Lagrangian formalism. And remember, there's a complete equivalence between the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian way of doing things through the Legendre transform. Then where we are now is we start with this completely covariant formulation of the Klein-Gordon theory, and we will start allowing curvature. Once we have allowed curvature and studied curvature a little bit, we will use the Legendre transform today to get back to the Hamiltonian formalism. But now, we will be in much better shape with the Hamiltonian formalism because we can do it now on curved space. In particular, we will now find, we will today find out what exactly the canonically conjugate momentum is to a field, the covariant version of that. That wasn't obvious from here. We started out by assuming that the momentum field is simply the time derivative of the field, but it won't be that in general. And from there, we can then quantize, and we start with that as well today. Okay, so step two, allowing curvature in the Klein-Gordon equation. We started with the Klein-Gordon action in special relativity. In special relativity, we can write it this way. The eta matrix is the matrix which has entries minus 1 and plus 1, plus 1, plus 1 on the diagonal. And that formulation of the Klein-Gordon action is correct for Minkowski space and any inertial Cartesian coordinate system. So it's got to be Cartesian coordinate system of an inertial observer. Then that's correct. By the way, the potential can be quite arbitrary in this business. The potential is a function of phi, capital phi, but in general, it can also depend on all sorts of other fields that our phi might be interacting with. Maybe it's better to close that. Oh, much better. Okay, so in our course, we will mostly deal with potentials of the kind that only describe self-interactions of a field with itself. Because in cosmology, that's justified. It turns out that the standard model of cosmology has it that the early universe was dominated by a scalar field that essentially only interacted with itself. Then, we went one step further. We said we want to describe the Klein-Gordon theory, still in Minkowski space, but allowing ourselves to use arbitrary coordinate systems. Not necessarily Cartesian coordinate systems, and not necessarily coordinate systems that are constant in time. They might also vary. They might vary in space and time. And we found that this is the covariant way to do this. This is the Klein-Gordon action written in such a way that this is the correct way of writing it, no matter what coordinate system we choose. So here, the metric tensor occurs, g mu nu, and also here, square root of the determinant of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric tensor. And if we choose a Cartesian coordinate system, then the metric tensor is simply the eta mu nu matrix again. Oh, we are using, I forgot, this signature convention where there's one plus one and the others are minus one. So in this case, choosing Cartesian coordinates on Minkowski space, we recover the action that we had earlier. But this is more general, much more general. if we choose a different coordinate system, for example, some sort of spherical coordinates, or you just draw some wild coordinates. Instead of setting up a rectangular coordinate system, set one up in which instead of the straight lines for the axis, you have some sort of curved lines, right? That's a valid coordinate system. And you can even make your coordinate system time dependent. You can have it rotate, spiral around. It's okay. You can choose whichever coordinate system you want. And nevertheless, this is going to be the correct action of our Klein-Gordon theory in Minkowski space. Only that we have to be careful that as we change coordinate system, the matrix G mu nu will change along with that. Namely, in this way, we found that if we go away from Cartesian coordinates of an inertial observer to some arbitrary coordinate system, some sort of carousel spiraling non-orthogonal coordinate system, then we get a metric tensor that a function for the metric tensor that looks very complicated in general, because it's arrived at from starting from the flat space Cartesian coordinate representation of the metric and then multiplying with this change of coordinate function. So you see that this is going to be, in general, rather complicated if the change of coordinate matrix is complicated. Nevertheless, what you can read off from this formula is that since alpha and beta are contracted with the same kind of matrix, we obtain that because eta is symmetric in alpha beta, also G is symmetric in mu and nu. That's automatic, no matter what change of coordinates we do. So, in general, in special relativity, the metric tensor function can be something very complicated, but it's always obtained in this way by a suitable change of coordinates from some Cartesian coordinate system of an inertial observer. This leads to a key question now. Do all metric tensor functions arise in this way? So if somebody gives you a matrix valued function, G mu nu of x, where x is some four variables, then you can ask, and let us ask that, is this always obtained from that matrix by a change of coordinates? And as we discussed at the end of the last lecture, the answer is no. You get a lot of symmetric matrices by these means, by starting with this and changing coordinates, but there are a lot of symmetric matrices, matrix valued functions, that you don't get in this way. And those will be the functions, the matrix valued functions, G mu nu of x, that describe curved spacetime. So mathematically, the question whether all metrics arise from eta mu nu in this way is the question whether any arbitrary G mu nu, or let's write it as rho mu nu, of x arises from this, as we said, right? It's just, I'm just repeating myself here. The answer is no. Metric functions G mu nu of x that do not arise in this way for any change of coordinates describe curved space times, curved in space and curved in time as well. Now, what that means is that we should think of space times separately from the metric tensor functions that describe them. It should be clear in our minds that if you take a space-time, which you can think of as some curved entity, then you can put many coordinate systems on that space-time. And therefore, you will arrive at many matrix-valued functions, G mu nu of x, that describe the very same space-time. Okay? So there is an infinite number of G mu nu of x's that all describe the same space-time. They're just different ways of representing the same space-time. Mathematically speaking, the space-time that we talk about is what is mathematically called a Lorentzian structure. And there are many different ways to describe that same Lorentzian structure. One matrix-valued function g minu of x or another one, doesn't matter. So there's an equivalence class of metric functions that describe the same space-time. Those metric functions are related to each other by a change of coordinates, which is differentiable. We assume it always to be a differentiable, so they're related by diffeomorphism. So the set of all metrics decomposes into equivalence classes. Two metrics are equivalent if they only differ by a change of coordinates, and they're non-equivalent if there's no change of coordinates that gets you from one to the other. And each equivalence class describes a space-time. It describes a Lorentzian structure. Now, see, this means that when you have a matrix-valued function, g minu of x, then there are two kinds of information in that matrix-valued function. On one hand, the matrix-valued function g minu of x will describe some space-time, be it flat or curved. It describes one of them. On the other hand, not every piece of structure that is in g minu of x is really describing a space-time, because some of what is in g minu of x is just choice of coordinates, right? I could change the coordinates, thereby change the matrix g minu of x, but not change the space-time that's being described there, because I'm just changing coordinates. And it is a major headache in gravity and quantum gravity that it's very difficult to disentangle those two different things, to disentangle the information that's in the matrix-valued function g minu of x that describes the structure, the curvature, how to disentangle that from what is merely choice of coordinates. However, while we cannot easily pin down where in that matrix-valued function the information about curvature sits and what is just change of choice of coordinates, we can easily count the number of degrees of freedom that are in there. So let's ask, how many independent degrees of freedom, let's call it d, describe a space-time fully? Here's the answer. Let's say n is the dimension of our space-time. So it's like 3 plus 1. Then the number of degrees of freedom in the metric, which really describe curvature, we can estimate to be this, which is for 3 plus 1 dimension of space-time, n is equal to 4. We have 4 times 5, half, that's 10, minus 4 is 6. So what I'm claiming here is that the metric has 6 independent degrees of freedom in it that actually describe curvature. The metric really is a 4 by 4 matrix valued function. So you would expect, well, maximally it could have 16 independent functions that you choose, right? But I'm saying, no, it's only 6. How come? Why that formula, not another one? Okay, so we start with a metric. It's a 4 by 4 matrix. And in principle, you can put whatever you want into those matrix elements as functions. So you have 16 arbitrary functions to choose. Not really, right? Because the metric has to be symmetric. It's symmetric even after change of coordinate. So we can restrict attention to only symmetric ones. There are only symmetric metrics. So how many degrees of freedom are left over then? Remember how to calculate that? Yeah, that's the first term there. That's right. So if you have an n by n matrix that is symmetric, then the number of independent entries is really n times n plus 1 half. Okay. Why is that? Yeah, that's right. But yeah, it's you take the number of entries minus the diagonal, right? So that's n times n minus, it's n squared minus n half. So you take n squared is all of them. And minus n, you subtract the diagonal. Then you have that the upper triangle is as many as you have in the lower triangle of the matrix. So you have n times, you have n squared minus n half. But then you add the diagonal, and that gives you n times n plus 1 half. Okay, so because the metric is symmetric, it has only n times n plus 1 half independent entries. However, we also have the freedom to change coordinates. That's the key thing that we were concerned about, right? And as we choose to go from one set of coordinates to another set of coordinates, we have the freedom to mess about with the entries of the metric. We could, for example, decide that this particular entry of the metric better be 5. I want it to be 5. That matrix element has to be 5. I can probably achieve that. I can find a coordinate system such that when I go through the calculation of what the metric looks like, then if I choose my change of coordinates correctly, I get this condition fulfilled. How many can I choose? Well, there are 4. Right? Because I have, in the four-dimensional space-time, I have 4 new coordinate functions in terms of the old coordinate, which means that I can impose 4 conditions on the metric. So the metric has this many independent degrees of freedom after taking into consideration that it's a symmetric matrix, n by n matrix. And then we can fix up to n conditions by choosing the coordinate system cleverly, right? So overall, we are left with this many, and that's 6 in the case of 3 plus 1 dimensional space times. So this is the number of degrees of freedom that the metric actually has. Now, for example, in the case of 2-dimensional space time, or just 2-dimensional surface or so, by the same argument, we have that there's only 1 degree of freedom, by the way. So curvature is a much more simple affair in 2 dimensions, which is really the highest dimension where we can still visualize what's going on. Right? It's difficult to visualize what the curvature in 3D is, of 3D is. But the curvature of a surface is easy to visualize. Right? You can think of, the, you know, put some osculating sphere in there and then check for the radius, and that just gives you 1 number. But in higher dimensions, curvature is a much more complicated thing. So we should be very careful when trying to extrapolate our mental image of what curvature is to higher dimensions. It has more degrees of freedom there. It's more complicated. All right, so we were talking about curvature all the time. But what is it really? How do we describe it? And how do we describe the evolution, first of all? How do we describe the evolution now of a Klein-Gordon field in the presence of curvature? When space-time is no longer Minkowski space, when the metric is not one of those metrics that is just up to coordinate change, the flat eta, the eta of flat space-time. But the strategy is we take the action as we had it before and don't change a thing. We just stick to it. We say, this is the Klein-Gordon action from which we can derive the Klein-Gordon equation and all that. This is the Klein-Gordon action for a scalar field in Minkowski space and arbitrary coordinate systems. That's why we had the G in there. And now we say, all right, we simply no longer restrict our Gs to be a G that comes from a flat space. And there we go. We already have the Klein-Gordon equation on curved space without any changes. I exaggerated a little bit. We don't really want to allow for all symmetric G menus. Well, we certainly want to allow for almost all symmetric G menus, even those which are not eta mu nu in any coordinate system. Right? That's the point. We want to go away from flat spaces. But we will want to insist that the g mu nus that we consider here are such that at any point of our choosing, we should be able to introduce a coordinate system such that at that point, the G mu nu is the eta mu nu. So we are not requiring that G mu nu can be made eta everywhere at once by a suitable change of coordinate system. No, but we are requiring that G mu nu can be made equal to eta, eta mu nu, at any point of our choosing. Only at that point, but there ought to be a coordinate system such that at any arbitrary point, it is the eta mu nu. And that is the equivalence principle. You see, what it means is that we are requiring that the metric tensor describes a space-time which is such that locally it is indistinguishable from special relativity's Minkowski space. Let's just look at the alternative. Imagine we were not to impose that condition on our G mu nu of x. And then we might end up considering, for example, a G mu nu, which is such that at a certain point, there is a coordinate system such that G mu nu is not the eta mu nu, but instead it's simply the identity matrix. So it has no minus sign in there. In this case, it means that we have only space coordinates or only time coordinates, right? We don't want that to happen. We should not be able to choose a coordinate system such that locally our space-time looks as if it's not a space-time, but just space. The signature must be the right one. Okay, so we insist on that. So we postulate, therefore, this is the mathematics of saying that we postulate that gravity can always be locally eliminated. So we assume, therefore, that if a freely falling observer sets up a small rectangular coordinate system, that's the coordinate system, it turns out, you need to use so that the G mu nu becomes the eta mu nu at a point. Then the observer will find that gravity is basically not there, that that locally, at the origin of that coordinate system, the metric takes the form of the eta. This was Einstein's starting point. Now that we have the Klein-Gordon equation, now that we have the Klein-Gordon action in flat as well as in curved space-time, let us look at curvature more closely. We use the term curvature loosely because we haven't really defined it. It just appeals to the fact that if the G mu nu cannot be made eta mu nu everywhere by choosing a suitable coordinate system, then the space cannot be Minkowski space. So it's got to be a non-Minkowski space, and that's what we will call curved. But there ought to be a better way to speak about curvature. You need to be able to properly define that. I'm assuming, of course, that you've all seen GR before to some extent, but just that we are on the same page, I'm going through these things quickly again. So let's say we are given a metric tensor, G mu nu of x, as an explicit matrix-valued function in some coordinates. So there's some coordinate system. Somebody gives you that 4x4 matrix-valued function. And you have no other information. You just know, well, that's a representation of the metric for some Lorentzian structure, for some space-time in some coordinate system. That's all you know. Then how do you determine whether or not this is corresponding to a flat space-time or something that is non-flat? How do you know whether or not this arises by a change of coordinates from eta or not globally? It seems a very hard problem because you would need to try out all possible changes of coordinates. That's difficult. Now, it turns out that this particular problem can be solved straightforwardly. This is one of the things that differential geometry does. For that purpose, let us define a so-called Christoffel symbol function. Remember, we assume we are given the matrix valued function G. Therefore, we can calculate this thing. We can calculate those so-called Christoffel symbol functions. Here the commas, remember, mean differentiation. So G alpha nu, comma beta means the derivative of G alpha nu in the direction x beta. And remember that the G with the upper indices is the inverse matrix of the G with the lower indices. Okay, so we defined this. And remember, the gamma symbol, the Christoffel symbol matrix valued function is quadratic in the metric. Now, next definition. I mean, it takes too far to explain exactly why this is the right form and why that would be the right form of defining something. But I'll make it plausible by showing you what you can then do with this thing. And that justifies why the definitions were as they are. So we take those gammas, which are now quadratic in the metric function G, and we use them to define our Riemann curvature tensor. This is the so-called Riemann curvature tensor. And you see that is now also a matrix valued function, except that it's not just a matrix with two indices, it's a matrix with four indices. This one has three, this one has four. So this is quadratic in G, quadratic in G. This is actually to the fourth power in G, and that is to the fourth power in G. It's a bit messy, but definitely if you're given the metric, a function, you can work out what that is. In fact, there are Maple packages for doing just that. Because you can imagine this gets messy. Because each one of those indices runs from 0 to 3. And we have four of them. So there are plenty of matrix elements. So what is the meaning of this Riemann curvature tensor? What can we do with that? It turns out that it can be used to calculate how much a vector changes its direction when parallel transported along a parallelogram. Technically, we say that a space is curved, or a space-time is curved, if the parallel transport of some vector v, so here's a vector v, and we are going to parallel transport it in this way. We parallel transported an infinitesimal distance along the direction of a vector eta. Then we are parallel transporting it an infinitesimal amount in the direction of some vector nu. And then back in the direction of eta, back in the direction of nu. And we arrive back at the point where we started. Only that the vector may have rotated in the process. Even though we've parallel transported the vector all along, the end result need not be parallel to the starting vector. To see this, imagine you are standing on a curved surface. Let's say you're standing on the North Pole, and you're stretching out your hand like this, pointing towards the South Pole. Can't help it but pointing towards the South Pole, right? Okay, so you point toward the South Pole, and now you start walking in the direction of the equator. When you are at the equator, you move left. And all the while, you just keep parallel transporting your arm, right? So you walk along the equator now, and then you walk backwards to the North Pole. And clearly, when you arrive at the North Pole, you're now pointing in a different direction from where you started, even though you've parallel transported all along the way. So parallel transport, or non-triviality of parallel transport, non-triviality of a closed loop of parallel transport, is an indicator for the presence of curvature. And the curvature tensor is measuring that. So if we parallel transport a vector v in the direction of along a parallelogram, which is spanned by vectors eta and nu, then the change in the direction of the vector v, so the change from v to v prime, v is the direction before it was parallel transported, v prime after, is given by what you get when you contract the Riemann curvature tensor with the two parallelogram directions and the vector that you wanted to parallel transport. So in other words, if you drop this for a moment and you just contract the eta and the nu with the Riemann curvature tensor, what you get is a rotation matrix, right? And so if it's a Riemannian manifold, so no time involved, then it's literally just a rotation. But if it's not, then it's a Lorentz transformation. So infinitesimal one. So the Riemann curvature tensor measures or quantifies how curved a space-time is. And you see that there are different kinds of curvature depending on where you put your parallelogram, in which direction you place it. Space-time may be curved in one direction but not in another. There is the possibility that the parallelogram doesn't even close. Mathematically, that's a possibility. You parallel transport in this direction, that direction, and then back, but it's actually not closing. This is the mathematical phenomenon of torsion. Strangely, nature doesn't seem to make use of that, which is weird, because at least it ought to quantum fluctuate into it. But we have absolutely no evidence that curvature is needed. That torsion is needed. But it's a possibility. Maybe worth keeping in mind. Of course, it's not for lack of trying. Einstein and many others have tried to find and identify a physical meaning of torsion, but it hasn't been confirmed.
What do you mean when you say the parallelogram doesn't even close? I mean, doesn't space-time have to be locally special relativistic?
Yes, but that's a different statement. This is up to second order. Right? Whereas the statement that you have locally special relativity is to first order only. And it doesn't mean that space is discontinuous, right? It's still a continuous, even differentiable manifold, and still you can have that torsion is present, and therefore parallelograms don't close. Now, it has been argued by Wald, for example, that torsion may be there, but if it's there, it need not necessarily be interpreted as parallelograms not closing. You may be able to, I didn't check that myself, but it may be possible to reinterpret the fact that parallelograms don't close as the presence of another force field, which basically gets our traveler off track. Right? So that may be another way of looking at what the torsion is. Now, here's a proposition. Assume that in the region A of space-time, the Riemann curvature tensor vanishes everywhere in that region. Then we can be sure, then and only then, can we be sure that there exist coordinates such that in this coordinate system, the metric tensor function actually is the eta mu nu, and therefore really we're dealing with flat space. So you can't have curvature when this thing is zero. And you must have curvature if it is not zero. So by just calculating from that given metric function, first the Christoffel symbols, then the Riemann curvature tensor, and then just checking whether the tensor is zero or not, you can find out whether or not there is a change of coordinates such that this is true. All right, so far we have allowed for space-time to be curved. And we found out how to describe, how to write down the action for a Klein-Gordon field in curved space-time. So we can now calculate what the dynamics is of a Klein-Gordon field in curved space-time. But what's the dynamics of space-time itself? If space-time can be curved in a space-dependent and time-dependent way, it probably should have some dynamics. It probably didn't just come into existence in a particular way, but it's a dynamical thing. And that is what general relativity describes. So what are the equations of motion for space-time's curvature, or for the metric, really? And that's a non-trivial thing, because we know that the degrees of freedom are somewhat hidden the curvature degrees of freedom are hidden in the metric, hidden in the curvature tensor, and therefore it's not so easy to quickly write down an equation of motion for them. Surely the curvature information is in there, but, well, it's 6 degrees of freedom out of 16. And if you get a complicated looking Jimmy Neu of X, as we discussed before, it can be complicated looking and very different from eta for 2 entirely different reasons. Either spacetime really has little or no curvature, and Jimmy Neu of X is non-trivial just because we have some unlucky choice of coordinates. You can make eta mu nu look terrible by just using terrible coordinate system. Or spacetime really is curved and no coordinate system could ever make it look like eta mu nu. Not globally anyway. Locally we always require that this is possible, not globally. Okay, so so it's difficult to pinpoint the curvature degrees of freedom in G, difficult to pinpoint them in the Riemann curvature tensor, especially because this thing also is coordinate system dependent. Therefore, in order to derive the equations of motion for the spacetime itself, we will try to get to something, our strategy will be to work with something that is coordinate system independent and therefore a scalar. So the strategy will be to construct a scalar that contains the curvature degrees of freedom, namely a scalar action. And once we have the scalar action, we should be able to calculate from it what the equations of motion should be. So how do we define now a scalar that we can use for an action for gravity? The first step is to start with the Riemann curvature tensor, which has 4 indices and is therefore surely not a scalar, and reduce the number of indices by contracting 2 of them with each other. So this one and that one, we contract with each other, and then we end up with a so-called Ricci tensor, which is a little step closer to a scalar that we could use in order to write down an action, which we could then use in order to calculate equations of motion for the curvature. Now, why would we contract in this particular way here? It turns out that you could also contract with this one and you just get an overall minus sign because of the anti-symmetry in those 2 indices there. And there are other ways to contract as well because, for example, if you put that one down, you have an overall symmetry between this one and that one, etc. There are lots of symmetries and anti-symmetries in the Riemann curvature tensor. But the point is that up to minus signs, this is the only thing you can get. You either get the same thing, if you contract in a different way, you either get the same tensor up to a plus or minus sign, or you get 0, because there are anti-symmetries in there. You can also contract so that you get a 0. So that's really the only way, really, to get a 2-component tensor out of the Riemann curvature tensor. Now, once we contract from here to there, let me just make that comment here. The R mu nu actually does contain less information than the R with the 4 indices. It's really a simplified version. I mean, it's clear that individual terms always carry more information than the sum of those terms. And this is obtained from that by summing. Right? What information are we losing here? Well, it turns out that when R mu nu of X is equal to 0, it doesn't mean that the Riemann curvature tensor is 0. Remember that we are dealing with flat space time if and only if this thing is vanishing. But if that thing is vanishing, that's not yet guaranteeing that the space is flat. For example, space may have, where this is vanishing, space-time may still have some curvature, just not all kinds of curvature. It can have what is called Ricci curvature, and that would be, for example, for A wild curvature, and that would be for the case of gravitational waves, for example. Yep.
So the four indices R and the two indices R are both derived from the same metric, right? So
yes.
What do you mean that the four indices contains less information than the two indices?
Oh, by that I mean that knowing this, you can calculate that, but knowing this, you cannot calculate that. If you have only the two index matrix, you cannot recover what that was. They depend, well, they both depend on the same information, namely the metric. But it's just that knowing this, you can calculate that, but not the other way around. And physically speaking, if this is vanishing, space is flat. If this is vanishing, it's not necessarily flat. It could still have gravitational waves and other phenomena. Okay, then let's further contract. So now we contract the Ricci tensor. I could also drop the metric here and just write it with one index up, one index down. In any case, we get the Ricci scalar now, and that of course has even less information in it. This is, remember, this contains now powers of G, right? R itself already had four powers of G, and each contraction gives us another power of G. So this is quite nonlinear in G. I'm mentioning this because that will later come up again. Now, the simplest scalar that we could have formed is not actually this one. Remember, all the information is in G. And if all we want is some scalar made out of G, that we could use as the action for gravity, for curvature, then we should have just, or could have tried to just take the metric and calculate a scalar from it, like this. Just contract the metric with itself. It's low power, it's just second power in G, and it's a scalar. The trouble is, the scalar is 4. Not very dynamical. We're unlikely to get equations of motion this way. But don't laugh, because nature apparently does this too. This term also occurs. It's the simplest term that could occur in the action, and apparently it's there. It's the cosmological constant. And then the next simplest term is this one that could be formed. And by that, I mean lowest power of G in there. Other terms could certainly be formed, but they would have to be some sort of powers of R's, contractions of Riemann curvature tensors with themselves, with G, with covariant derivatives of the Riemann curvature tensor, and so on. So very high powers in G. So the simplest two terms, let's just keep that in mind, the simplest two scalars we can form from the metric are this one, a constant, and any multiple of it, of course, and the Ricci scalar. So therefore, the gravitational action, we can already conjecture. The total action of everything that goes on in nature should be an action that depends on the metric, which encodes the shape of space-time, depends on the scalar field phi that we will be focusing on for the purpose of cosmology, and it depends on a bunch of other fields, electrons, quarks, gluons, anything you like, bunch of other fields as well. And by the way, the terminology is, in cosmology, it's quite an unusual one, that we speak here of the metric, we speak of the space-time degrees of freedom, that's plausible, and then of everything else, the whole rest of it is called matter. So this is space-time, and this is matter. But this is a little unusual, because even the electromagnetic field would here be called matter. So everything that's not space-time is matter in cosmology. It's just a weird way of calling things. Just like in a star, you know, carbon would be called, or you know, carbon would be called a metal. That's just how astrophysicists call everything that's a little heavier than hydrogen and then helium and so on. Okay, so the total action depends on the metric and then all of the matter fields, which is our scalar field phi and everything else, all the other fields that we know of in nature. In practice, that's the Klein-Gordon action that we wrote down earlier. then there's the action of the standard model of all the other particles, of electrons, quarks, gluons, W, Z bosons, all the other leptons, etc. All goes in here and is symbolized here by this little f. And then there's the gravitational action that we still have to write down. So the gravitational action, since the action is always a scalar, we assume to be built from the simplest scalars you can build from the metric. And that would be a constant. Remember, that's our number 4 up there. It's just g mu. It's a constant. That's certainly a scalar, plus some other constant times the Ricci scalar, plus some constant and then something else scalar made out of the curvature tensor and higher order stuff in the curvature tensor. And for the whole thing to become covariant, remember we have this. Remember we need the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g to absorb the non-triviality of how this changes of under coordinate changes. Okay, so this is the assumption for what the gravitational action looks like. In practice, we can test this. We can calculate what the equations of motion are that follow from this, and then compare with the experimental evidence. And what we find then is that there is no experimental evidence for C2, C3, and the other Cs to be anything other than 0. And there is experimental evidence for this and experimental evidence for that. This is the experiment that C0 is not 0, is the experimental evidence for the cosmological constant. And C1, if chosen correctly, gives us Einstein's general relativity, which of course reduces to Newton's theory in the non-relativistic limit. So if we choose the C1 appropriately, then we recover Einstein's general relativity with a cosmological constant. Namely, we should choose the C0 and the C1 in this way. This is 1 over 16 pi g. We could call it whatever we want, but if we put it like this, then g is the Newton constant. And lambda here is the cosmological constant. And traditionally, we put it here multiplied with that prefactor with the 2 here. Of course, that's totally arbitrary. You could redefine that. Now, what are the equations of motion? There are 3 kinds of equations of motion because our action depends on 3 kinds of dynamical quantities. Our total action depends on the standard model fields. The total action depends on the metric, and the total action depends on the Klein-Gordon field. Remember that the total action had a term for phi, it had a term for the Einstein action, and that's what we just wrote down, the first 2 terms there. And the total action also had the Klein-Gordon action in it. So what are the equations of motion then? Everything's still classical, of course. Well, classically, we require that these equations of motion hold. And these will be the standard models, equations of motion for electrons, all sorts of leptons, all sorts of bosons. This will be the Einstein equations, and this will be the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's start with the equations of motion for the standard model. If you really want to work that out, what you have to do is, in principle, calculate that functional derivative here, and then you get the Dirac equation for the various fermions, and you get the Maxwell equations for electromagnetism, etc. If you want to do a quantization, then the best way to do that then is to do a Legendre transform from the Lagrangian formulation. You see, the what you have to do here is to differentiate the standard model part of the action with respect to the standard model fields. And the standard model part of the action is the time integral over the standard model Lagrangian. Once you have the standard model Lagrangian, you can do a Legendre transform to the standard model Hamiltonian. Once you have the standard model Hamiltonian, you can then impose the canonical commutation relations and start solving this. which is not trivial. In fact, in Minkowski space, we know how to do this. But on curved space times, there are issues with gauge theories. Issues that wouldn't be an issue on flat space time. But that's not the subject of this course, because we don't have evidence that this gauge issue is of cosmological significance. It might turn out to be, but so far we don't have positive evidence for that. But maybe you want to keep that in mind, that there are still unresolved problems with the quantization of standard model fields on curved spacetime. And by that I mean spinners and gauge fields. Then, so we have three things, right? We have the equations of motion for the standard model fields, we have the equations of motion for the metric, that's what we will do now, and then the Klein-Gordon. So here, in order to get the equations of motion for the metric, we take the total action and differentiate it with respect to the metric tensor and set that equal to zero. Notice that there is a subtle difference to what we had earlier. Earlier we had this. We said, in order to obtain the standard model equations of motion, we take the total action, we functionally differentiate it with respect to the standard model field, gives us the equations of motion. Here it seems we do the same thing with the metric. There's a slight difference. Remember, this thing consists of three terms. There's the action for the standard model field, there's the action for the Klein-Gordon field, there's the action for gravity. In fact, in order to work that out, we don't need the three parts. We only need the standard model part of the action, right? Because the Klein-Gordon part doesn't depend on the standard model fields, and neither does the gravity part depend on the standard model field. So you only need the standard model action differentiated with respect to phi, and you get the equations of motion of the standard model field. Still non-trivial, because the metric has its fingers in there everywhere. Because even the standard model action has the metric in it. Right, because it has to be covariant. So the metric enters into the standard model action. So the standard model equations of motion will have the non-trivial metric and curvature and all of that in it. That's why it's still difficult to do it and to do the quantization of it. But my message is, you actually differentiate only the standard model action part with respect to phi. The differentiation of the Einstein action with respect to phi is zero anyway, because phi just doesn't occur in it, and the Klein-Gordon action also doesn't have the little phi in it. Different here. That's different here, because when we calculate what is the functional derivative of the total action with respect to g, then we really have to differentiate all three terms that are in the action. The Einstein action term for gravity, the Klein-Gordon action term, and the standard model action term. And why is that? Well, it's because all of those terms have g in it. Even if only because all of those terms are multiplied with the square root of the determinant of g. Right? Because that multiplies everything. Right? So this factor is everywhere in every action. But every action has also some covariant derivatives, has some metrics in there to contract indices, and so on. So the generic thing is that every term in every action has the metric in it. And therefore, all of this stuff is contributing to that equation of motion. This is the mathematics of the statement that gravity couples to everything. Everything gravitates. So when we differentiate the total action with respect to the metric, we get two kinds of contributions. One is when we happen to differentiate the Einstein action with respect to the metric. That gives us this. If you want to know how that exactly comes about, please look up my lecture notes of the course last term. Okay, so if you differentiate the Einstein action with respect to the metric, you get this. If you remember, that was the first term of the Einstein action. I mean, it had the cosmological constant in it, and then there was this other term of the Einstein action, which had the Ricci scalar in it. Its functional derivative with respect to g mu nu gives us this. But then we also have to differentiate the standard model part of the action and the Klein-Gordon part of the action with respect to g mu nu. And that will give us terms as well. How those terms look like depend very much on what these matter actions are. For example, if it's a Klein-Gordon field, then the Klein-Gordon action will give us, when differentiated with respect to G mu nu, some certain terms. Electromagnetism's action, differentiated with respect to G mu nu, gives us some other terms. If you take some quark fields and take their action and differentiate it with respect to G mu nu, we get some other contribution. All of those contributions are usually just assembled together, and the whole bunch of them is called T mu nu of X. And that is the energy momentum tensor. It's the derivative of the action with respect to all kinds of fields, cosmologically speaking, all kinds of matter fields, and it's just this whole bunch there. Okay, so this left-hand side is the functional derivative of the gravitational action with respect to the metric, and that is the functional derivative up to a minus sign of the matter action with respect to the metric, T mu nu being the energy momentum tensor. Now, at this point, let us neglect the standard model fields. Of course, they're going to contribute on the right-hand side. It's just that in the early universe, the evidence indicates that the right-hand side was completely dominated by a scalar field, by this field capital phi. So therefore, for cosmological purposes, let us neglect the standard model fields and instead focus on a scalar field, a Klein-Gordon field, the so-called inflaton field. Now, when you take the Klein-Gordon action and you functionally differentiate it with respect to G mu nu, then what you get for the right-hand side here is this. Okay, so that's the functional derivative of the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the G mu nu. And you can carry that out yourself. We studied the functional derivatives. So if the Klein-Gordon action has some potential in it, it shows up in this way. So you notice the Klein-Gordon action's derivative with respect to the metric, so the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor contains the field, and it contains the metric. Why does it contain the field twice? I mean, quadratically? Well, the Klein-Gordon action contains the field quadratically. Okay. Remember, Klein-Gordon action is how far do we have to go? Ah, there we go. So you see the Klein-Gordon action contains the field quadratically. Okay, and then there's the potential as well. If we differentiate that Klein-Gordon action with respect to the metric, we get terms that are quadratic in phi, because we're not differentiating with respect to phi for this purpose. We're differentiating with respect to g. So we get quadratic terms in phi. And we get a lot of terms because we have to differentiate with respect to all occurrences of g. Here's an occurrence of g, and there's an occurrence of g as well. Okay. So that's the outcome of functionally differentiating the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the metric. Then, how to quantize this thing? Well, by quantizing this thing, I mean that. What's the quantization of this? The quantum theory of that. See, there are many problems with this. Many problems with developing a theory of quantum gravity. One of them is this. R, you know, has several powers of g in it. And there's yet another one. And this thing also has g in it, right? Because it is, if you remember, there it is. Energy momentum tensor of our Klein-Gordon field is this. It also has g in it. So in other words, this is a differential equation for g, but it's highly nonlinear. It has derivatives of g because R has the Christoffel in it, and Christoffel symbols have derivatives of g. So it has derivatives of g, it has powers of g. The whole thing is a very nonlinear equation in g. And on top of that, on top of having to solve the Einstein equation, we also have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, which again has dependence on G. And classically already, that's difficult to solve the Einstein equation together with the Klein-Gordon equation, but it can be solved, for example, for the case of some spherically symmetric Klein-Gordon field of Klein-Gordon photons that would, for example, converge and form eventually a black hole. That sort of thing can be calculated analytically. So it's not out of the question. If you have a lot of symmetry in the situation, then you can reduce the number of degrees of freedom dramatically, and then you can do it. But as far as the quantum theory is concerned, the fact that it's so highly nonlinear with G is really messy. Also, how do you do perturbation theory in G? Very difficult. You can't perturb around G equals zero. That wouldn't be right, right? Like for a scalar field, you can quantize around G equals zero for small phi. But what does it mean, small g? OK, so then you can take some g as a background and do perturbation theory for g's around that. But what does that mean? You can always change coordinates such that the entries of the matrix G blow up or become small. Very difficult to do perturbation theory covariantly when you can't really disentangle the actual shape degrees of freedom from the coordinate choice degrees of freedom. Okay, so how to, so the quantization of the Einstein equation is very difficult. I mentioned this already, difficult to separate the curvature degrees of freedom from mere artifacts of the choice of coordinate system. And Einstein equation is highly nonlinear in G. Oh, and there's one more thing. This the left-hand side describes or is an expression of the curvature at the point x. The right-hand side is the energy momentum tensor at x. And why not? But quantum theoretically, that's a little messy because energy and momentum are supposed to be, quantum mechanically, non-local. If you know the energy or the momentum, then you don't know where or when, right? By the uncertainty principle. So it seems to be built in that there is trouble with quantization, that the left-hand side is geometric and local, and the right-hand side, energy and momentum, don't want to be local. Okay. So how will we here proceed? In this course, we will initially consider general relativity's space-time as being classical and given as a background. So we assume that we've solved the Einstein equations and we found some space-time that is, let's say, expanding radically or normally now and whatever. We find some solution for the Einstein equation, and that gives us a G mu of x in whichever coordinates we may want to work with. But we assume this as a given thing, and it's classical. So it's both given and classical. And then on that background space-time, on that background expanding space-time, we will study what the quantum field does. So what does the Klein-Gordon field do when it lives on a space-time that is expanding dramatically? And we will find that it does lots of unexpected stuff. Finally, however, we will also consider small perturbations of the metric tensor, and we will quantize those. So it is a partial quantization of gravity. And it's not that we just feel like doing that, even though it's so hard to do, but it's necessary, actually, because it turns out that, strictly speaking, fluctuations of a scalar field on a spacetime cannot cleanly be separated from, cannot always be cleanly separated from perturbations of the metric itself. You can't really have that this thing is fluctuating and the space-time is not. I mean, there are very deep reasons, but an obvious reason is that if you look at the Einstein equation and you say that the left-hand side is classical, and given and fixed, and the right-hand side is this, which is really that. And here the quantum field is fluctuating. Well, you know, those fluctuations ought to make that fluctuate as well. It turns out that when phi is fluctuating, then this will induce a fluctuation here, which will induce a fluctuation there, but it doesn't mean that everything in the curvature has to fluctuate. It's just a particular part, and we will be able to identify what part of the metric it is that fluctuates in sync with the phi field. And so we will have to quantize both that part of the metric that is coupled through the Einstein equation to the field phi. And we will have to quantize them both. Also, it should be clear why a fluctuating phi field is not going to make the entire metric, the entire curvature fluctuate. That's just because the scalar field phi is scalar. It's just 1 degree of freedom. Curvature has way more degrees of freedom. So the scalar phi is not coupled to all degrees of freedom of shape in the manifold of curvature, but just a particular one. That one we'll identify and do the quantization of. Okay, so remember we studied A. We took the entire action, which is the standard model action, plus the Klein-Gordon action, plus the Einstein action, and then we said, what equations of motion does it give us? And A was, we studied the functional derivative of the total action with respect to the standard model fields, giving us the standard model equations of motion. Secondly, the functional derivative of the total action with respect to the metric, that gave us the Einstein equation, we just had that. And now finally, the functional derivative of the total action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field, which should give us the Klein-Gordon equation. So we have the total action, and we differentiate it with respect to phi, set that equal to zero. We take the total action, but really we know, of course, that in the total action, phi only occurs in the Klein-Gordon part. Phi does not occur in the standard model part, does not occur in the Einstein action part.
I just don't understand why you say that, like, you're taking quantum fluctuations on one side and will affect the other side. So then why can't you not do that when you are quantizing? Like, if you quantize this side, then what is the problem?
Okay.
I don't understand why one is valid and the other is.
No, we'll have to do both. That's what I'm saying. We are quantizing the field phi, and that will force us to quantize at least a part of the metric. And the other parts would be very difficult. I mean, yes, we do some other things as well, but we still can't do really the quantization of the full gravity. We just quantize some perturbations. It's not entirely satisfactory because really it's a highly nonlinear theory, and because G occurs all over the place. And therefore we're only capturing something that scratches the surface when we do it perturbatively. It might well be that we are missing out on something qualitative, not just quantitative. Okay, so here we differentiate the total action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field phi. So we're really differentiating the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the Klein-Gordon field phi. The metric is, of course, contained in this. Comes up everywhere. So that's our equation of motion, really. Because there's no dependence of phi in the other two parts of the action. And we obtain this Klein-Gordon equation. Here's the Klein-Gordon action again. We had that earlier. This is an example of what the potential could look like. It's the type of potential that's being considered in cosmology. Others as well, but that's one of those that's being considered in cosmology. And then we can calculate what the Euler Lagrange equations are. What the equations of motions are from the Euler-Lagrange equation. Remember that once we have the action of a theory, then these are the equations of motion. In the particular case of the Klein-Gordon field, we obtain that these are therefore the equations of motion. You know how to work out now the functional differentiations. So you can take at home this action, perform those functional derivatives and that ordinary derivative, and then obtain the equations of motion. So here's the Klein-Gordon equation in general relativity then. It's this one. And just to clean it up a little bit, this equation, it looks like that. And you see that there are plenty of occurrences of the metric here. Like here we have 1 over square root of absolute value of the determinant of g, regular partial derivative, metric, again this business with the determinant, and that's equal to 0. This phi to the third term is arising from the potential, from the phi to the fourth potential, if we want to include the potential. What happens if we work with flat space, Minkowski space, and choose Cartesian coordinates of an inertial observer? Well, then this should simplify to what we know. Let's check whether it does. So the metric becomes the eta, and then what we have is that the determinant, square root of the determinant, etc., is just 1. So that is a factor of 1. That's a factor of 1. And this becomes the eta mu nu. So what we really have here is a first derivative, and then makes it a second derivative. Since this thing is diagonal, we really have just the second time derivative minus the second space derivative, which is the Klein-Gordon equation as, or the Klein-Gordon operator as you know it, on Minkowski space. And then that's just the usual thing. Since this operator here, the wave operator for a scalar field in curved spacetime, is so important, we give it a name. It's the D'Alembert operator for curved space. So it's this. This is what happens to the Laplace operator on curved spacetime. It's still a second derivative operator, but it's no longer as easy as taking the second time derivative and subtracting the sum of the second space derivatives. In fact, in general, it's rather messy because this derivative acts on all of this, right? So you have to take a field. If you want to apply that to a field, you have to differentiate the field and then multiply with this and then differentiate the whole bunch and then divide by that. The benefit of making that definition for the second derivative operator is that now we can write this complicated looking Klein-Gordon equation for curved space in this simple way, where we have to keep in mind that this box here, the D'Alembert operator, depends heavily on G, because it's this thing here.
So the second term, the m squared phi or phi?
Oh, it's phi. Thank you. Thank you. Where? What do you mean? Oh, same thing. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. That's the trouble with copy and paste. You see this? This was really copied and pasted. If you look at it closely, identical. Okay. All right. So Klein-Gordon equation. Where are we here? So we've finished this this step here. We now have the general relativistic formulation of the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. But how to quantize that? For quantization, we need canonical commutation relation between what and what. We have the Klein-Gordon equation, all right. Here it is. But what is the phi supposed to not commute with? It's got to be some sort of pi. Let's calculate what the canonically conjugate to phi is. Well, this is the step now going from the Lagrangian formulation in general relativity using the Legendre transform to a Hamiltonian formulation. It's still covariant, it just won't look covariant, but it still is covariant. Because remember that this is a transformation that is invertible. So if this theory is covariant, then if we now apply the Legendre transform, which is an invertible map, to get another formulation, then no matter how ugly it looks, or pretty it looks, no matter how it looks, it's going to be a covariant theory. Even if it singles out the time or the energy over space and momentum. Okay, so that's the strategy now. We do a Legendre transform from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian formulation, and then we can quantize. Let's do that after the break, and let me just give you a small indication of something that will come up later in this course. This is not the only way to proceed. This is the way that we will proceed now, after the break, from the Lagrangian using the Legendre transform to the Hamiltonian formalism. Then we will have phi and a canonically conjugate momentum field phi, and then we can quantize that, and then we have our quantum field theory, general relativistic, second quantized. There's another way to do it, which goes back to Feynman. And Feynman said, well, it's so beautiful that it's covariant. We really surely shouldn't use a formulation that doesn't look covariant, even if it is. So is there not a way to quantize the theory that doesn't require us to go through a Hamiltonian? And there is, and that's the Feynman path integral. Using the Feynman path integral, we obtain a formulation of quantum field theory on curved space, which looks rather different from that over there. But it turns out that the so-called Dyson-Schwinger equations are the same. And so they really describe the same theory. Let me just make a few comments about this. Second quantization in the path integral. Let's assume that the fixed spacetime is chosen and that the G mu of x is given. Then for any phi of x and t, we can calculate what its Klein-Gordon action is. Namely, we just plug that phi into the formula for the Klein-Gordon action, and we get a number out of it, a certain scalar. It doesn't matter in which coordinate system we do this. It's always going to come out the same number. That's the point of this being scalar, that being scalar. Completely coordinate system independent thing to do, to take a field and plug it into the action to get a number. Then Feynman says, OK, there should be probability amplitude for this particular field evolution to happen. This is very naively speaking, but it helps the intuition, even though it's not strictly what you could do measurement-wise. So he says, let's define a probability amplitude for this particular field evolution. Namely, the amplitude for this particular thing to happen, so the field to take such and such values at such and such times, that probability amplitude is, by assumption, e to the power of I over h bar times that number that we get for the field, the Klein-Gordon action. Which means that for every field configuration here, phi of x and t, we get a probability amplitude, which is some complex number, in fact, a phase. And Feynman suggests to treat this like a probability. So if they are mutually exclusive possibilities, then they add up. If one is conditional on the other, they would multiply. So then if, for example, we want to calculate what the vacuum expectation value is, of the product of two fields, which is the correlator between the fluctuations at one point and the fluctuations at another point, just one of those things that we may want to calculate, if we want to calculate this thing, then for Feynman, this is like calculating an expectation value. So you take the measurement value, phi of x prime at t, and you multiply this actual value with the probability that it occurs. It's really probability amplitude. You multiply it with the probability that it occurs, the probability amplitude that it occurs, and sum over all possibilities, over all phi, formally. Technically, this is not a well-defined thing. for space-time, but there are tricks to deal with it anyway. So the idea is that if you can work out that path integral, then you get the expectation value of that product, and that would be your prediction for the quantum field theory. And you notice that in no place did we have to break the symmetry between space and time. This is all totally covariant, because this only deals with actions and so on. There's no Hamiltonian in this. There's not even any Hilbert space in this coming up. And amazingly, it turns out that when you calculate the correlator between field amplitudes here and there in this way, you get the same thing as if you did it this way. The trouble with this method here is, the trouble with Feynman's method is that it's mathematically ill-defined, and there are a huge number of open physical questions. In the case of the standard model of particle physics in Minkowski space, those issues have all been resolved, and they are not all that hard to resolve. Therefore, it's actually very convenient to pursue Feynman's method for particle physics. It's covariant. You know, if you know that everything you do has a covariant shape in the equations, you can often predict what the result is going to be, because it has to have certain index structures in order to be covariant. So it's very useful to do that in the case of particle physics. But in case of curved space, there are tremendous difficulties that we really have no idea how to address in the path integral formulation. For example, which state is the right vacuum state? That's a Hilbert space issue kind of question. Here, it has all the questions of quantum field theory have, of course, corresponding formulations in the path integral formulation than they have in the operator formalism. But some questions are much easier addressed in one formalism than in the other. And it turns out that in cosmology, quantum field theory and curved space in general, virtually all questions are much easier addressed in the operator formulation than this one, which is really a pity, because especially on curved space, we would like to keep the covariant. It's very difficult. But you may want to keep that in mind, because it might be that solving some of the outstanding problems in the operator formulation requires you to do it in a path integral way. Might be. Okay, so after the break, we will go this way. And then towards the end of the course, we will actually do that as well. But first, we do all of the cosmology, everything in the operator formulation, and there will be one lecture that actually carries that one out. OK? So let's go into the break.